you ever feel that God is invisible? That he is absent from the world? That he might not be active right now? Do you ever wonder how we should act in a world where others seem more powerful? Where governments seem to be in total control? Where God's people get sidelined? Did you know there's a Bible book all about that? Over the next few weeks, I'm going to be sharing my sermon series from the book of Esther. Esther's a book where God's name doesn't even come up once, but when we look carefully, God is extremely active. It's a book with conspiracies, misuse of power, supposed coincidences, relationships, and far more. Are you intrigued? Well, let's dive in, shall we?
Esther chapter 2, verses 1 to 20. Later, when King Xerxes' fury had subsided, he remembered Vashti and what she had done and what he had decreed about her. Then the king's personal attendants proposed, "Let a search be made for beautiful young virgins for the king. Let the king appoint commissioners in every province of his realm to bring all these beautiful young women into the harem at the citadel of Susa. Let them be placed under the care of Hegai, the king's eunuch, who is in charge of the women, and let beauty treatments be given to them. Then let the young woman who pleases the king be queen instead of Vashti." This advice appealed to the king, and he followed it. Now, there was in the citadel of Susa a Jew of the tribe of Benjamin named Mordecai, son of Jair, the son of Shimei, the son of Kish, who had been carried into exile from Jerusalem by Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, among those taken captive with Jehoiachin, king of Judah. Mordecai had a cousin named Hadassah, whom he brought up because she had neither father nor mother. This young woman, who was also known as Esther, had a lovely figure and was beautiful. Mordecai had taken her as his own daughter when her father and mother died. When the king's order and edict had been proclaimed, many young women were brought to the citadel of Susa, put under the care of Hegai. Esther also was taken to the king's palace and entrusted to Hegai, who had in charge of the harem. She pleased him and won his favour. Immediately he provided her with her beauty treatments and special food. He assigned to her 7 female attendants selected from the king's palace and moved her and her attendants into the best place in the harem. Esther had not revealed her nationality and family background because Mordecai had forbidden her to do so. Every day he walked to and fro near the courtyard of the harem to find out how Esther was and what was happening to her. Before a young woman's turn came to go in to King Xerxes, she had to complete 12 months of beauty treatments prescribed for the women, 6 months with oil of myrrh and 6 with perfumes and cosmetics. And this is how she would go to the king. Anything she wanted was given to her to take with her from the harem to the king's palace. In the evening, she would go there and in the morning return to another part of the harem for the care of Shaskaz, the king's eunuch who was in charge of the concubines. She would not return to the king unless he was pleased with her and summoned her by name. When the turn came for Esther, the young woman Mordecai had adopted, the daughter of his uncle Abihail, to go to the king, she asked for nothing other than what Hegai, the king's eunuch, who was in charge of the harem, suggested. And Esther won the favour of everyone who saw her. She was taken to King Xerxes in the royal residence in the 10th month, the month of Tebenth, and in the 7th year of his reign. Now the king was attracted to Esther more than to any of the other women, and she won his favour and approval more than any of the other virgins. So he set a royal crown on her head and made her queen instead of Vashti. And the king gave a great banquet, Esther's banquet, for all his nobles and officials. He proclaimed a holiday throughout the provinces and distributed gifts with royal liberality. When the virgins were assembled a second time, Mordecai was sitting at the king's gate, but Esther had kept secret her family background and nationality, just as Mordecai had told her to do. For she continued to follow Mordecai's instructions, as she had done when he was bringing her up. We're back this evening in the world that is missing God. This is the book of Esther, isn't it? Where the powerful seem godlike, and the world appears to revolve around them. And this evening, here in Esther chapter 2, we're shown what life in that world looks like. What life looked like for those without the power. Without the power in the empire of Xerxes. And we noted, as we've gone through so far, that the Empire of Xerxes is in fact the empire of the world. You can see his kingdom there on the screen behind you. It's a yellow bit. It's stretching as far as the eye can see. It encompassed most of the known world at that time. And there was a pull. There was a temptation. There was a desire to be part of this kingdom. And even if you were immune to that desire, there was still no escaping it. The Empire of Xerxes claimed everything. Your body, your sexuality, your career, your hopes, your dreams, your aspirations, your children. The list goes on and on. It doesn't take much, does it, to see the same pull in our world today. I mean, we might be separated from Esther by 2,500-ish years, but the world around us hasn't really changed that much. See, this evening we're going to see a morally ambiguous and complex situation. We're going to see a situation that is realistic, a situation that real life often is like in this fallen world. And the point of this, the big thing to think this evening, is how do we respond? How do we respond to life in a world missing God? What does it look like in a world missing God? What does it look like? Well, first of all, it's a life that's based on looks. You see, we've already seen, haven't we, that looks matter in the book of Esther. Do you remember the big show, the pomp, the splendour? All of it saying, this is it. All of it looking visually impressive. All of it looking good. And we saw last week what happened when things didn't look good. We saw the king, didn't we, being publicly shamed by his wife. And that didn't end well. It ended with a godlike judgment flooding the world with Vashti's dismissal and this royal decree going out. See, in the world, in this world, missing gods, everything is done on appearance. It's a life based on looks. Everyone wants to be seen as honoured. It matters how everything looks. And that continues in our passage this evening. Have a look at verses 1 to 4. See, later when King Xerxes' fury had subsided, he remembered Vashti and what she had done and what he had decreed about her. Then the king's personal attendants proposed, let a search be made for beautiful young virgins for the king. Let the king appoint commissioners in every province of his realm to bring all these beautiful young women into the harem at the citadel of Susa. Let them be placed under the care of Hegai, the king's eunuch, who is in charge of the women, and let beauty treatments be given to them. Then let the young woman who pleases the king be queen instead of Vashti. This advice appealed to the king, and he followed it. So go and find all the beautiful young virgins for the king. Go and look at how they look. Judge them on their appearance. And if they look good, take them, put them into the harem, that's the women's house, for King Xerxes. I mean, we bristle at that, don't we? For good reason. This is a despicable world, isn't it? All of it is based on looks and appearance. But just imagine living in that world. Just imagine the pull. There is something to being chosen, isn't there? I mean, if you're chosen, you're taken away. That's not ideal. But what would happen if you weren't chosen? What is that going to do to your honour? What, you mean I'm not picked? I'm not good enough for the king. Come say that to my face. I mean, you'd want to be picked and you wouldn't want to be picked at the same time. It's an impossible situation, isn't it? Verse 4 makes the point twice more. Let the young woman who pleases the king, or that's more literally, who is good in the king's eyes, become queen. And of course, end of verse 4, this advice appealed, or again, literally, it was good in the eyes of the king. Which of course underlines the fact that looks are exactly how this whole empire runs. The world that misses God runs on what you can see. And as we'll see, not on what really is. I mean, is our world any different? Just think about our society's obsession with social media. What do you do with social media? You put the best photos of yourself on there for everyone to see. Or just think about opinions. There are some opinions, aren't there, that you just should keep to yourself. You only have to look at the Scottish MP, Kate Forbes, to see this week the media attacking her for her public views. We all care what each other think, or what we think. Everyone thinks that everyone else thinks one way. And so, we want to be seen to be thinking that way too, don't we? Of course, we might rightly bristle at the idea of a sex contest. That's what this is. From megalomaniac king of the world. But at the end of the day, is our world really that different? You see, in a world that misses God, appearances matter. In a world missing God, it's a life that is based on looks. And that leads us to the next thing to think about this evening. In a world that is missing God, people feel weak. I don't know how you feel. Perhaps you think of yourself as feeling quite weak in all of this. Well, we've seen the power of the king resulting in the powerlessness of the people. This is a game of empire that you just can't win. Women across the world, remember that map, all of that kingdom, taken and put into storage for the king. The author here subtly points that out to us in the language he uses. He's using language that is used elsewhere in the Bible of storing grain away in the famine. These women are being treated like grain. They're being treated like stuff that belongs to Xerxes. Like grain shoved in storage, crammed in storage for when Xerxes needs it. Well, the second half of our passage, verse 12, just hear what these women went through. Before a young woman's turn came to go into King Xerxes, she had to complete 12 months of beauty treatments prescribed for women. 6 months with oil of myrrh and 6 with perfumes and cosmetics. And this is how she would go to the king. Anything she wanted was given to her to take with her from the harem to the king's palace. In the evening, she would go there. In the morning, return to another part of the harem in the care of Shaskaz, the king's eunuch, who's in charge of the concubines. She would not return to the king unless he was pleased with her and summoned her by name. 12 months of beauty treatments. I mean, that's 6 months of oils and 6 months of cosmetics. I mean, what is that? What do you think about that? Sounds like pampering, doesn't it? Cucumbers, mud baths. No, that's not the point. See, this was all for the king. In fact, again, the author's using language that's used elsewhere for embalming a corpse. That's the time this language is used elsewhere in the Bible. For mummifying a dead body. For mummifying a thing. This is women, again, being used as things, as objects, as Xerxes' personal playthings. They have no life of their own. They only return to the king if he summons them. Otherwise, they live a bleak, uneventful life. You see the weakness here of being one of these women? And if we think this is sexist, well, historians tell us that he did the same thing to the men as well. He would take the young boys and castrate them to make into his eunuchs. We have those eunuchs here in this passage. I don't think any of us should be thinking this is the dream life. But he's right in the middle of that. We're in the middle of that structurally, with this abuse on either side, that we literally find God's people. See, in the middle of our passage, verses 5 to 7. Now there was in the citadel of Susa a Jew of the tribe of Benjamin named Mordecai, son of Jair, the son of Shimei, the son of Kish, who had been carried away into exile from Jerusalem by Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, among those taken captive with Jehoiachin, king of Judah. Mordecai had a cousin named Hadassah, whom he had brought up because she had neither father nor mother. This young woman, who was also known as Esther, had a lovely figure and was beautiful. Mordecai had taken her as his own daughter when her father and mother died. Right there in the middle, Mordecai and Esther. We're told Mordecai is a Jew. He's one of God's people. That's how we're meant to understand this. And as we go through Esther, that is important. The Jews are God's people here. God's people in the middle of the world. His family is from the tribe of Benjamin. That's one of the final tribes of Israel to be exiled. He was named Mordecai, the son of Jair, the son of Shimei, the son of Kish. I mean, those names, they're all meant to connect us to King Saul. You're meant to think Saul when you hear those names. He's got a pedigree to him. And we're told that his family had been carried off into exile. The author repeats the idea to make sure we get it. Let me read a more literal translation, verse 6. He had been exiled into exile from Jerusalem by Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, among the exiles, exiled with Jehoiachin, king of Judah. Did you hear it? He's in exile. Mordecai is in a weak position. He's where he doesn't belong. He's a stranger in the world, you might say. Although he does have someone with him, doesn't he? His cousin, Hadassah. Well, she's an orphan being brought up by Mordecai. These two members of God's people, they are stuck in the middle of this world empire. They are individually, corporately, positionally weak. And it happens, unfortunately for Esther, that she has a lovely figure and is beautiful. You see, well, that's going to go straight away, can't you? There's a at the door, the king's decree, and Esther is taken. There's no arguing with the empire about it. For Esther, there's as much power as arguing with God when he took away her parents, or Mordecai's ancestors arguing when they were exiled from Jerusalem. There's nothing you can do about it. It's a position of weakness. Yet there is one final aspect of all this that should command our attention this evening, and that is the matter of identity. Perhaps you know this one as well. In a world missing God, there is a conflict of identity. See, Mordecai and his cousin, they stand out in this text because they belong to God, because they have an identity. And this passage is throwing that identity into the spotlight. So we said that Mordecai is from a line of people with biblical names. He's from a right stock. His father's got a good name. But Mordecai's name, well, actually, that's quite dubious. You see, Mordecai is a Persian name. More than that, Mordecai was actually the name of a Persian god, the god Marduk. That's highlighted even further with his cousin. She's named Hadassah, which means myrtle. Myrtle trees in the Bible are connected to God's promises. And she's also named Esther. A name we've said already means hidden. Or a name that comes from another Persian god called Ishtar. But you see, both of these characters, they have two identities. You have Mordecai the Jew and Mordecai the Persian. You have Hadassah and you have Esther. You have Myrtle and you have Ishtar. The identity is hidden. Beneath the Persian story, behind the story of the world, there is the Jewish story. There is God's story. God's people here, they're caught between two worlds. And aren't we too? Strangers and exiles in the world. And I remember being younger and having my church friends and having my school friends. And the worst thing I could imagine happening was for those two groups to meet. But that's what always did happen. In the supermarket, at that birthday party. The question is, who are you really? And that is what is flung into the light here in Esther 2. As we saw, that decree has gone out and Esther fitted the bill. So she's taken, that language there is passive, it's done to her. It's like she's an object. She looks good, but she's weak, so she's taken. Have a look at verse 8. She's brought to the king's palace. She's entrusted to Haggai, who's in charge. There she is good in his eyes, and she wins his favour. Well, the language there suggests that she's actively, deliberately winning Haggai's favour. Is that a good or bad thing? We're not told. Verse 10, she doesn't reveal her identity. Is that a good or a bad thing? Again, we're not told. It's ambiguous. It's dubious. There are two identities going on. And the most dubious part of all of this is by the end of this story this evening, she ends up in the bed of the Gentile, uncircumcised king. Who is Esther? A Persian or one of God's people? Which one of those titles sums her up? Where does her loyalty lie? It's tricky, isn't it? I've gone backwards and forwards on this question multiple times, and I've come to the conclusion that that is the point. You're meant to be doing that. See, the characters in this story, they're not clean, and they certainly are not perfect. But the point isn't to learn morals from Esther. You wouldn't use Esther's life to teach virtue to your teenage daughter. I mean, what message would she get? Make yourself as attractive as possible to powerful men. Use your body to advance the kingdom of God. The ends justify the means. That's not the point here. The author doesn't want to hold Esther up as an example to follow. So don't worry this evening whether Esther was cheerful and willing or angry and reluctant. The story just doesn't tell us. I mean, we'd love to cheer, wouldn't we? You say, good old Esther. She went to the king kicking and screaming. Or perhaps we're going, tut, tut, Esther. You shouldn't have gone and slept with a Gentile king like that. The author's not interested in that at the moment. All we know is that she goes to the king likes her. She wins the competition, she's made queen. Although, as we've seen, that might bode as well as becoming the queen to someone like King Henry VIII. Divorce beheaded died, divorce beheaded... Yeah, it goes well, doesn't it? But the big point here is that this is what life in a world missing God looks like. And when we think about it, that's what we know already, isn't it? Where do you fit with this? Where do you feel this pull? Do you feel it when you're trying to get the job? When you're trying to be comfortable? When you're trying to just fit in? Doesn't matter if I cut some corners. Now, I'm hoping that no one here is auditioning to be one of the king's bed partners today. But when our identity comes up, when our identity comes into question, what do we do? Where do we go? Are we part of this world? Or are we part of God's people? So it's easy to say the ends justify the means. I mean, they seem to here. Esther's now the queen. I mean, that's going to be useful, isn't it? The king is happy again. Great. We're back to banqueting. And there's even, verse 18, there's even a bank holiday for everyone to enjoy. Now, the point here is in a world missing God, life is messy. Such an immensely real story, isn't it? Now, we're going to see how this story unfolds over the next few weeks. We probably know already. But this passage here should make us question, are we sure that that is it? Is it true that all we can see is all that there is? Can we be certain that the only visible, only the visible stuff explains everything? I mean, we now have a new queen. Just a coincidence? We'll see. Is it that God actually uses the weak and the powerless and the people who don't do good to save his people? Isaiah 53 might say something there. But we're meant to grapple with that as we read through the book of Esther. We're meant to be sceptical of this. Because as we start to think that there might be someone behind the curtain, as we begin to question this narrative, it's going to help us get our priorities straight. It's going to help us to make the right decisions rather than the murky, ambiguous, dubious ones that we see in a passage like this evening.
Thank you so much for listening. Any feedback or questions can be sent to podcast@david-couch.com, and I'll catch you again next time.